Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, do you use abductive reasoning? Ken explains what it is and appropriate uses for this kind of reasoning. And Ken, I know you often talk about a little joke where you're not referring to people being abducted into a flying saucer when it comes to abductive reasoning, right?
That's correct. That's a very popular form of abduction, but we'll leave the UFOs out of this program and just stick to some cold-hearted logic.
All right, sounds good.
Well, I'm happy to say, guys, that my new book, Christianity Cross-Examined, I think it's off to a good start. You know, my books don't sell as well as Hugh and some of these other Christian celebrity types, but it's done well on Amazon. And what's more important, I think, as an author, particularly when you spend a lot of time trying to write a good quality book, you want that book to help people, to influence people. And I remember reading about C.S. Lewis, and he thought if you wrote a book and somebody engaged you, you had a responsibility to interact with them. And apparently Lewis wrote, and his brother Warney typed, between 10 and 12,000 letters to people who talked with them. So I'm telling our listeners right here and now that if they write to me, they're going to get a response.
There you go.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about faith and reason. Joe, that abductive type of reasoning that we'll get into in this program and carry it over to the next is a part of that subject. And I think there are enduring questions to Christianity. One of the enduring challenges or questions, of course, is the problem of evil, pain, and suffering. I don't think that ever goes away. I think Christians have good answers. And of course, chapter 12 of my book, I try to bring some of those answers to bear. But I think that there's another issue here that is a perennial challenge, and that is the relationship between faith and reason. That is a topic that critics of Christianity in the ancient world raised. I mean, you got to remember that the worldview, the intellectual worldview surrounding the Roman Empire at Christianity's beginning was, you know, this Greco-Roman worldview. And you had Platonism, and you had Aristotelianism and Stoicism. You had Greek and Roman deities. And so some of the critics of Christianity said, I'm not sure that this is really an intellectual faith. This seems to be more emotional. It seems to be less intellectual. So this question of faith and reason remains. And of course, if we move all the way up today, where our worldview, I guess it probably would be seen as reflecting a number of worldviews. One of them, of course, would be naturalism. In fact, we could say many people today are deeply influenced by a scientific naturalism. They think that the only way of really knowing something is through science. We call that scientism. But of course, we also have the flip side, and that is we have another worldview that I think greatly influenced people in our time. And that is something like postmodernism, where you have a deep suspicion of worldview ideas, and everything is relative, whether it's truth or whether it's morality. Everything is relative. Everything is pluralistic. So we have a variety of views that are expressed, but I think there are still plenty of people today who wonder, how can I be a person of faith and be a person of reason? They seem at odds, and of course some people within the church I think have made the mistake of giving up reason, where they think that maybe their personal experience in faith is more important than being reasonable and rational, although I think that's always been a minority, and I think it's a minority today. But what I'd like to begin with is to give some reasons why I think faith and reason go together. And again, this is in chapter 3, and I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on these points. I'm just going to kind of give them and maybe give a brief explanation. And Joe and Dave, you can stop me at any point and we can talk about them. I think one way, this will be number one, I think one way that faith and reason go together in historic Christianity is I think that faith's definition involves reason. And I think that this is significant. How would I define faith? I think if you look at historic Christianity, you search the scriptures, you look at historic Christianity, I think a dominant definition of faith is confident trust in a reliable source. I mean, pistuo is the word faith. Pistis is the noun faith. Pistuo means to believe. New Testament, of course, written in Greek. I think that that definition bears out confident trust in a reliable source. Notice it's not confident trust in just anything or everything. It's the definition of faith itself includes not just trust, but trust in a reliable source. And that reliable source could be God, it could be Christ, it could be the truth, could be the chair I'm sitting in. I'm confident this chair is going to hold me up. So I don't think you can criticize Christians for having a definition of faith that doesn't have a rational component. And, you know, I think you can see this in other ways as well. Jesus always tells people, hey, put it to the test. You know, the apostles put it to the test. So that would be number one. Number two, I think faith involves knowledge. You know, knowledge is a very particular thing. To have knowledge, I have to believe something and it has to be true. My belief has to match reality. Well, to be a Christian, you have to have knowledge. Who was Jesus? What did Jesus do that makes me right with God? So in the New Testament, faith involves knowledge as Jesus as the Son of God, the Savior of the world, some concept of the atonement that he's making me right with God. So I don't think that faith lacks knowledge necessarily. Again, some kind of unusual views of faith might do that. A third, faith and reason, I think, are complementary. They go together. I think that they complement one another. And thus, it involves all of our faculties. Sometimes in theology, we talk about saving faith. It involves the mind, knowledge. It involves the will, assent. It involves the heart, trust. So I think that what we're seeing here with Christian faith is it's very robust. It involves the whole person. Number four, faith is compatible with reason. I think you can have facts and reasons and evidence. I don't think that there is a retreat into anti-intellectualism. That would be number four. Number five would be the idea, and I think that this is a very important, faith can't be fully comprehended by reason, but faith does no damage to reason. Now, the reason I bring this up, and I think it's worthy of our discussion in the context of faith and reason, Christianity also involves a lot of mystery. I mean, God is infinite and eternal. We're finite and temporal creatures. I think everything about God is going to be mysterious. But, of course, mysterious doesn't mean that it's contradictory. I can never get my mind around the Trinity, but I don't think the Trinity is an inherent contradiction. I cannot get my mind around, as hard as I try, around the incarnation, that Jesus is somehow a single person with both a divine and human nature. I can't fully comprehend that. I can't exhaustively understand that. But I think I can state it, and I think the church has stated it, historic Christianity has stated it, in a way that avoids logical contradiction. And I again, I think everything about God is mysterious. His attributes, you know, that we're made in the image of God, that's mysterious. The atonement is mysterious, but something can be mysterious in the sense that I can't comprehend it totally, but it isn't necessarily a logical contradiction. That would be number five. Number six, and I think that, again, this is a very important one. We'll talk more about it as we go forth in our two programs. God's rational mind grounds human reason. You know, one of my favorite contemporary philosophers is Alvin Plantinga, and Plantinga has kind of picked up ideas that other Christian thinkers set forth and developed this idea that science and evolution are in conflict with each other. And I won't go into a lot of detail, but I'll just simply say that people like Al Plantinga and other Christian philosophers and apologists and thinkers, he thinks that evolution cannot give you confidence that your beliefs are really true. I mean, if there's no God behind the universe and we're the product of blind, accidental physical processes, then who's to say that our brain has evolved in such a way that it gives us true beliefs about reality? I mean, I think that that's a very difficult thing. I mean, if there's no mind behind the universe, then how do I know that my mind is actually credible, accurate? Now again, if I posit God's mind and he creates other creatures, though they're finite and temporal, yet he creates them with cognitive faculties that work properly. So God can provide a ground. You know, I remember C.S. Lewis saying, what if you were pouring some milk and you spilled it, and the spill matched perfectly with a map of London? Would you think that the spilled map that looks like a blueprint would actually match London? Well, it just happened by accident. There was no design. There was no purpose. And so people like Alvin Plantinga and C.S. Lewis and many others have said, I think to have confidence that our mind can give us true beliefs about reality needs God. Now, what's interesting is I think that sometimes skeptics, they confirm that. I remember Michael Shermer and Lawrence Krauss saying the reason why human beings believe in God and believe in life after death is that these beliefs, even though they're totally false, they gave you survival advantages. Hmm. Well, I'm like, lay it on me, brother, because what you're telling me here is evolution has put false beliefs in my mind. I think that we need a ground. Hmm. We need some basis to say, I can have confidence in my mind. That would be six. Seven, I think the Bible promotes intellectual virtues. I would only say, you know, Christians are often very good at talking about moral virtues. You know, be faithful to your spouse. Don't steal. Don't lie. But there are also intellectual virtues that Paul talks about. Paul talks about checking sources, right? Acts, book of Acts, the Bereans are more noble than the Thessalonians. Why? Because they're taking a look at the Hebrew Old Testament, putting the Apostle Paul to the test. Test all things, hold on to that which is good. 1 Thessalonians 5:21. John says, don't believe every spirit. Don't be gullible. Test them. There are intellectual virtues in the Bible, and those intellectual virtues were robust in Judaism and in Christianity. I think those intellectual virtues are seen in Christian history, where Christians care about scholarship, they care about books, they care about reason. They care about loving God. And I think this is maybe the best way to communicate it to people today. I think God wants you to love him with your mind. Really, with all that you have. So if you're, you know, if you are gifted intellectually, use that gift the way you would use any other gift to love the Lord. Number eight, I touched upon this briefly. Christianity promotes and appeals to rational investigation of truth. I think in the Gospels, the apostles tell us, take a look. You know, these things didn't happen in a vacuum. 500 witnesses to the resurrection. Examine this case. And Jesus does that. You know, if you don't believe my word, then take a look at the works I do. Look at the miracles. Then he says something I wish I could say to my family on Christmas or Thanksgiving. Who of you can point to any sin in my life? I mean, if I did that, my family would fall over laughing. But Jesus can do it. And in fact, he not only does that to his apostles and to the common folk in Galilee, but he says that to Pontius Pilate. He says that to the Jewish religious leaders. You know, take a look. Do I have the resume? Do I have the qualities of the Messiah? Number 8. Number 9, Christianity made great contributions to many rational disciplines. And I think this is one that really is very important. Years ago, when I first started studying logic, and by the way, when I first started studying logic, I wasn't all that good at it right away. I remember my first logic class. I was like, whoa. I was learning what is an argument, what are premises, what's a conclusion, what's a logical inference, how about these fallacies, what about formal logic. I was going through this material I had not been exposed to before, and I was like, wow, I gotta work on this. But what I discovered is the more I applied myself, the more careful, the more consistent I became as a Christian thinker. And in fact, I think the biggest advance in my logical thinking is when I began teaching. Because I knew what questions students might ask, I would have to really focus in on that. Well, here is an interesting story. The first logic book that I used, I would say this was probably 1983 or around there sometime. I was still an undergraduate at the time. We used a book called A Concise Introduction to Logic. It was written by a philosopher named Patrick Hurley. Patrick Hurley, I later came to know, taught at San Diego University, which is a Catholic liberal arts college. And we used the first edition of the book. And later, I had the opportunity to do some email interaction with Hurley, because I began using his book as a professor. And what was interesting is in that book, and it's that way today, even though the editions have advanced through the years, Hurley has a list of 10 eminent logicians, 10 eminent logicians. So, you know, the first one is Aristotle. He's the father of logic. I mean, wasn't the first one to think logically, but Aristotle was the first one to formulate logic and systematize it. And so he gets the great title, the father of logic. But you know what? When I looked up all those individuals, six of the 10 had direct connections to Christianity. So I'm thinking, if Christianity is not a rational religion, if Christianity is somehow substandard intellectually, why have there been so many leading logicians who have made advancements in logic? Could it be that these people did not see reason and their faith as being at odds with one another? And I can also move to the area of science. When people say science and Christianity are at odds with one another, I say, well, then why was the worldview in about 1650 in Europe, why was the Christian worldview the worldview that birthed science? And why were so many of the founding fathers of science Christian or Jewish? So I think this idea that they've contributed to rational fields is significant. And here's a tenth one. I think that Christianity contains a reasonable diversity of perspectives. Now, that can be bad or good. You know, sometimes I'm a little concerned about the lack of unity within Christianity. My take, my approach is I tend to begin with what Christians have in common. You know, for example, when I look at Catholics and Protestants and Orthodox, and I look at what they believe in common and then the areas of difference, I have to say I'm more impressed with what they have in common. Some people take the other position, say, no, I'm more influenced by the real differences that are there. But what's interesting is while Christianity can seem divided, and I think to some degree it is, I don't think it's hopelessly divided. I think the creeds are a great example of the common Christianity, what C.S. Lewis would call mere Christianity. But here's a point I'm making. Christianity contains a reasonable diversity of perspective. And that is this. I think if you went to a Christian university, a top-notch one, not all Christian universities are created equal, but some are really top-notch. I think what you will find that within Christianity, you'll actually get more perspectives, more points of view than you will in a secular university. For example, I have Christian friends who are philosophers, and they're very skilled at presenting the naturalist position. They're often very well knowledgeable about Buddhism and Hinduism, and they can tell you, well, here's how the Buddhist would look at it. Here's one Hindu perspective. I think, however, in our world, in our secular environment, to some degree, secularism doesn't allow other competing views to come in. I have found that within Christian intellectual centers, I think that they're more robust, they're fair, they'll allow you to go back and forth. Even in science, hey, you want to look at evolutionary creation? Let's take a look. You want to examine the young earth view? Okay. You want to take a look at the progressive old earth view? Let's do it. Think of these four view books. How many four view books have you seen? I think there is the idea that while we need a lot of unity, that I think that Christian intellectual people, you'll learn a lot because they're more open to saying people take different positions. So that's my 10. Joe, Dave, I don't know if you want to comment.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, a question. Do you find in your experience with skeptics, Ken, that they're at all persuaded by the argument you just laid out or the 10 components of faith and reason? Or do they look at it as, yeah, Christians can be logical, but it's in spite of that their faith that they can think reasonably rather than because of their faith that they can think reasonably? In other words, the faith is more like baggage they bring into it. How do you think the skeptic perceives faith and reason?
Let me add to that. You know, I think what I'm going to ask is a similar kind of thing, that I'm often accused of having blind faith. And blind faith, in their view, is faith that can't be tested by a scientific process, or at least the scientific processes that, you know, are generally accepted today. And so, you know, you fall into this same category that Joe is talking about here. So maybe you want to comment on that.
Yeah, let me say a couple of things. One, I want to talk more about that, Dave, as we go forward, because I think the Christian explanatory nature is very powerful. That is, I think when we look at the universe, when we look at Big Bang cosmology's insistence that the universe had a beginning, I think when we look at fine-tuning, I think when we look at later ideas about you know, the fine-tuning even of the Earth, the Moon, our solar system. I think that there are ways of testing some of those ideas. I think scripture pretty clearly teaches creation ex nihilo. I think there are ways of testing those things. Certainly when it comes to the resurrection, now we can't test the resurrection scientifically as if we could repeat it, but I think we can test it in terms of history, its factual nature, whether those testimonies are credible. But I want to go in that direction, so I'm going to return, and when I do, I want you to jump in again on that topic. Let me respond to something that Joe said. One of the things I say in my latest book is, I think the old atheists are more formidable than the new atheists. Of course, the new atheists, the four horsemen of the new atheism, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens. I think that those four, and you could add others, Jerry Coyne, Peter Atkins, I think there are others that kind of fit in that kind of category. Lawrence Krauss would be another one. I don't think they're as formidable as the old atheists. Now, who are the old atheists? Well, Bertrand Russell, when I was a student, I had to read Russell, wrote a book, Why I Am Not a Christian. He advanced mathematics and philosophy. He was a brilliant intellectual. I had to read J.L. Mackey, his book, The Miracle of Theism. I had to read Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist philosopher. And then, of course, maybe my favorite, Friedrich Nietzsche, God is Dead. Joe, what I found is that the old atheists, they were very formidable. And I think the reason for that is they understood Christianity. And I think they understood Christianity because they had to. They had come out of a civilization that had prized Christianity. They had been exposed to Western civilization where Christianity has many influences. So they were aware that you can't easily sidestep Augustine, Anselm, Thomas Aquinas. And there, I think there are people today who would say, you know, you really can't sidestep people like Alvin Plantinga or Richard Swinburne or William Lane Craig. But I think too that the old atheists, because they had studied Christianity, because they were oriented toward argument, I think the new atheists, they are oriented, and maybe the best example is the late Christopher Hitchens. I think that they have more rhetorical skill. They can create an environment that, you know, uses sarcasm and ridicule, and blames religion poisons everything. Well, it may poison some things, but, you know, it seemingly produce the great universities in Europe like Cambridge and Oxford and the University of Paris and places like that. I think, Joe, that I think one thing that is absent from a lot of unbelief today is they don't have a good awareness of Christianity. They don't really know who Saint Augustine is. They can't really quote Thomas Aquinas. And I think that those who can, they realize that it's not easy to debate Alvin Plantinga or Richard Swinburne or William Lane Craig or Hugh Ross, any number of people. That would be my point. Sometimes these arguments are not very effective because I don't think the critics of Christianity have given it enough thought. I mean, who was it? I think it was Chesterton who said that, you know, Christianity hasn't been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried.
Hmm. Yeah. By the way, the scripture supports the idea that when you are having your life in harmony with God, you become wiser than your teachers.
Yeah.
And so that has a it reflects the ideas that you were saying earlier about how Christianity supports logic and reason and intellectual rationality.
You know, what's interesting, Dave, is when you look to what we call the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, so this would be Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, it says that, I'm trying to remember exactly how it reads, that fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Right.
And I think that word fear there conveys more the idea of reverence than it does, you know, I'm afraid of God. But, you know, when you look at Judaism, when you look at the Jewish people, they have been, they're considered the most successful minority group in the history of America. Now how do they measure that? I think primarily they measure it in terms of the level of education, the number of people in the professions from a Jewish point of view. So many doctors, many lawyers, many academicians, if you will.
Professors. Physicists.
I think that, I think Judaism and Christianity have an enormous intellectual influence on the world. And by the way, I would add that I think that Islam does as well, that there really is an intellectual side of Islam. And I'm not talking about radical Islam, but kind of the old school intellectual. In Baghdad in 800, you had a very diverse Islamic background, but see, they see themselves also as people of the book. So I think those ideas are important. Well, let me make a transition here, if I could. Joe, you at the beginning of our program talked a little bit about abductive reasoning, and I'm sure our listeners are very familiar with inductive and deductive reasoning. I mean, in deduction, you set up the argument in such a way to have premises that are not only true, but they support the conclusions. And so if you set up a deductive argument that is sound, you're going to have certainly true conclusions. And so, you know, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Induction, of course, is a very important type of reasoning. I think scientists reason in all three ways. They reason deductively, inductively, and abductively. But I think it's fair to say that the scientific method itself kind of runs on induction, where you're looking at probabilities. One thing, Dave, that I have come aware from talking to you and to Fuzz and to Hugh and Jeff is how important models are, and the ability then to take the data and see if it supports or denies the model. Well, induction, again, probabilities, very important part. But then there's a third lesser known type of reasoning. And again, some logicians would simply call abduction as a special type of induction. I don't look at it that way, not because I think that it couldn't be interpreted that way, but I like to distinguish the abductive reasoning. And so if deduction provides certainty and if induction provides probability, then abduction provides plausibility. Mm. So you're not trying to predict anything. I mean, if I ask the question, how did JFK get assassinated in Dallas, Texas in November 22nd, 1963? Was it a conspiracy? Was there multiple gunmen? Or was there a single gunman? I can't repeat that. Who'd want to repeat that god-awful day when the president of the United States was murdered at high noon? I always had a fascination with the Kennedy assassination. And I thought the other day is, I think it was the funeral that really just kind of threw me. I remember seeing Jacqueline Kennedy in, you know, in her black dress. And I remember the caisson carrying the casket covered by an American flag and the drums. And I thought, wow. Well, I can't repeat that, but I can look at it abductively. I can ask, which seems to have the best explanatory power? Which theory tends to stand up? So this abductive form of reasoning, I think, is a very powerful approach to Christianity. Let me tell you that I went to an eye doctor just a number of months ago, and I can't help but ask these doctors philosophical questions. After they examined both of my eyes for like an hour, he says, "Do you have any questions?" I said, "Well, just philosophical questions." So I asked him. I said, "You know, when you develop, as a doctor, when you develop a diagnosis, I said, how much of that is based upon your training? How much of that is the tests you're looking at? How much of that is based upon your experience as a doctor?" And then I said, how much of it is just educated guessing? And my wife always told, don't say that to a doctor. You know, you're right. He might poke you in the eye after that.
or give you an extra dose of that air that goes in your eye, you know, that little puff of air.
That's right. I mean, my wife says, be very gentle there when you ask these kinds of questions. Well, you know, sometimes with the doctors, they actually like it. It's like, well, but I feel like I'm back in medical school and kind of thinking about knowledge and epistemology and things like that. Sometimes they just want to get me out of there and get the next person in so, you know, they can get it done. But what's interesting, guys, is this abductive approach. I think anybody who is engaged in what I would call diagnostic thinking is embracing abductive reasoning. I love detective shows. I've always liked cop shows, growing up watching them on TV. I have some friends who are detectives. They move from clues and they develop a theory. They, you know, maybe they're crime scene investigators. They come in and look at the bloody mess and they start thinking, okay, how do I come up with a story, a narrative, a theory that best explains all of this? They're engaged in a diagnostic. They don't give us probabilities or certainties. They give us a plausible explanation. Historians look at facts and offer to interpret those facts. They offer historical interpretation of what happened in these events. Scientists, I mentioned that I think scientists engage in all three forms of reasoning, deduction, induction, and abduction. And I would say, Dave, I would say that I think that the development of the natural sciences is one of the greatest intellectual accomplishments by human beings. I think that science is just heady. It's a heady enterprise. It doesn't mean scientists always get it right, but it is, I remember during the early stages of the pandemic, seemed like some of the scientists were kind of confused. There was so much data kind of hitting them and they're trying to think it through and kind of then work it through. Science is a very heady discipline, but you have abduction in looking at the data and developing a hypothesis. I think hypothesis development is really an abductive process. And I then would compare that with another science-oriented discipline, and that would be medicine. I mean, again, my doctors, they will, they look at my symptoms. You know, one time I had my head was just clogged. So the doctor looks, you know, he takes this little thing and looks in my ears and said, well, you know, your head's full of wax. We need to get that wax out of there. So they look at my symptoms, but then they do an evaluation. They do some tests. Then then they look at my past records and say, well, you know, you seem to have an allergic reaction to penicillin. Well, so this kind of diagnostic thinking, you know, doctors move from symptoms to a diagnosis. And of course, the one that I like to finish on is with my dad. My dad was, his early days, he was a coal miner in West Virginia, but after World War II, he became an automobile mechanic. And I always think to myself, how influential have automobiles been in the history of our nation? I mean, you know, Eisenhower, after World War II, he becomes president and creates the freeway system. And so my dad had a whole new career working on cars, working on trucks. And I remember the old days, my dad would tune up cars for people in the neighborhood, particularly elderly women who their husband had died. My dad, I think, had a real sense as a Christian that he wanted to serve. He wanted to help people. He thought that a very important part of Christianity was doing good things. And he thought, well, what I can help maybe these ladies, I can help them take care of their automobile. They've outlived their husband. So we'd have these elderly ladies pull their car up in the driveway, and my dad would open the hood, and he just listened to the engine. And sometimes he could tell them, this is what the problem is. You know, he would tell them, this is a carburetor problem. This is a transmission problem. And I remember as a youth, I thought, man, my dad's like he's a shaman. This must be supernatural. And I asked the kids I went to school with, can your dad do that? Of course, later I took an automobile mechanics class in high school. I didn't learn a whole lot, but I took the class, and I realized that an internal combustion engine is kind of like mechanics are kind of like doctors. There is kind of like symptoms. And my dad knew just by listening to the engine, sometimes he could detect, okay, you know, he was a troubleshooter. So when they had a difficult engine, they call my dad in, and my dad would work as a diagnostician. Well, I think that that's very engaging. I would say that abductive reasoning is some of the most sophisticated reasoning that people do. And by the way, I don't think it's just experts who do this. My example is you're sleeping in on Saturday morning, you open the blinds, peek through the blinds, and you see that the streets are wet. Your mind immediately provides an explanation, must have rained. Of course, on the second and fourth Tuesday of the month in my neighborhood, you've got the street sweeper, so that could be it. Or I could be having an illusion, I could be dreaming. But some logicians would say, for example, that abductive reasoning is kind of the most human-oriented reasoning that we do, that our mind just naturally asks, how do I explain this phenomenon? So I think, by the way, that approach to reasoning fits really well with Christianity. I think that there's a way of approaching these kinds of issues. And, you know, when we think about them, you need a lot of explanation. I mean, the world. Dave, earlier you raised the question of, can we put these beliefs to a test? I mean, at least scientists, they try to develop a model that could then be potentially knocked down. And, you know, I always get a kick out of hearing Hugh say how many times the Big Bang has passed another test. And I'm like, man, how many tests has it undergone? But this kind of rigor of seeking to falsify it, well, I think good explanations have to apply to the world. I think good explanations have to apply to human beings. I think they have to apply to our religious revelation and ideas. And that then is the direction that I want to go in. Let me pause and see if there's a question or two.
Well, I just like the way you introduced abductive reasoning as producing plausibility. I like that word because I think it might help when Christians engage skeptics and they're thinking, this guy's going to try to prove something to me. Well, no, not necessarily. We're just trying to get you to think that could the Christian faith be rational? Could it be plausible, plausibly true? So I think I like that aspect of it, the way you kind of, where you laid it out there. I think in some ways, I think that's maybe even more persuasive than other methods.
Of course, one of the problems that we face is that in the sort of scope of things that people are willing to consider as potential explanations, they exclude, you know, supernatural. They exclude anything that is beyond what we can see and measure. You know, there's the cosmos, and that's it. There's, as Carl says, there's nothing before or after or beyond this cosmos, this world that we, universe in which we live.
Well, let's take both of those ideas, Joe. The, you know, the way you framed it, I feel very comfortable with that too. One thing I like about abductive reasoning is I'm saying to the person that I'm talking to, maybe the person is, maybe they're a Muslim or a Hindu, or maybe they're an agnostic or an atheist, some kind of skeptic. I'm not saying I can prove these things. I mean, there are Christian thinkers through the centuries that have thought they could provide arguments that were on the level of proof. I'm not so sure about that idea. I mean, I think the five ways of Thomas Aquinas are, in my mind, pretty persuasive. Do they rise to the level of a proof? Well, that's another question. But I'm, even if I thought an argument was a proof, I may not want to go in that way, because persuasion is not just the arguments. It's also whether you are perceived of as being a thoughtful, fair-minded person. And what I mean by that is, I might want to say, well, you know, the naturalist has some explanatory power. I'm not saying that your worldview is completely false. You know, there may be areas where maybe naturalism has more explanatory power than does a religious perspective. And I think one thing that's powerful about this idea is it's not a special type of reasoning. You know, you Christians, you engage in this magical reasoning. No, detectives, historians, scientists, physicians, mechanics, they kind of reason in this kind of direction. Mm-hmm. So I like that. And by the way, I think it's also more modest in the sense that I'm not necessarily saying Christianity is true. I am saying that it is rationally plausible. Now, I might want to take it further. I may want to then make an argument and say, well, I think these other worldviews are even less plausible or implausible. But some people would criticize abductive reasoning by saying, well, yeah, but maybe what you end up with is, you know, empty holes in the buckets. This isn't a perfect argument, and that's not a perfect argument, and that's not a perfect argument. So you put them together and you get three imperfect arguments. Well, I would accept the idea that abductive thinking is modest. But I think that's the way people normally reason, and I think it's really well suited to Christianity in kind of approaching that. Now, Dave, you've raised something too that I think is worthy of our, you know, our kind of reflection. You know, what I think is really interesting is, I said earlier, Dave, I think that science is such a heady enterprise. I mean, you know, I've had the pleasure of meeting many scientists through working at RTB, and it's been a great pleasure. I meet people constantly who have advanced degrees in very technical fields. And what I think is interesting too is that, you know, science, it attempts to recruit the best people, you know, get some of the brightest minds, gives them some of the best training. in scientific discipline, mathematics. But then there's kind of an irony to it, and that is that the scientific enterprise picks the brightest and the best, gives them incredible specialized training, only to kind of generally conclude with a worldview that says there's no mind, there's no reason behind the universe. And I'm like, that seems kind of unusual to me. But nevertheless, let me raise, Dave, a question with you. And that is, you know, sometimes, and maybe I don't understand this because I'm not a scientist, I'm a layperson. But sometimes it seems to me that the scientific community doesn't allow everybody a seat at the table. Sometimes my young Earth friends, they get treated pretty critically. Or maybe some of my ID friends, they get treated very critically. Or, you know, even Paul Davies, when he came along and said, well, you know, science kind of does their work on faith. They have kind of a worldview. And man, some of the critics really went after poor Paul Davies and just told him, you're giving sustenance to religious people. Now I realize, Dave, that not every position deserves a place at the table. I mean, some views you have to kind of exclude, but I guess I want to ask you the question. I mean, you got a PhD in physics from one of the elite mathematics science schools, Caltech here in Southern California. You know, you're a bright bulb. You're one of the best read people I know. How do you, am I correct that science at times does kind of limit explanations? And do you think that's good or bad?
I mean, I think it does. I think, you know, I would never attempt to give up or give a lecture at Caltech, say in the astronomy department where I was working, and include something about my faith in God or some religious or, you know, theological aspect of my, you know, my life. So, I mean, I would expect to be, you know, it would cause embarrassment and they'd, you know, never invite me back and this kind of thing, which was really remarkable in the sense that when here back in the early 90s, I had the opportunity to go and speak as a scientist, but also as a Christian at the Russian Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg.
Wow.
They invited people. I think that the Russian scientists there had come to the conclusion that atheism was not the answer. And they didn't know whether Christianity was, but they were open to the idea that maybe there was some merit here. And so they invited me as a scientist to speak about my research so they could kind of, you know, gauge my credibility. And then they gave me equal opportunity to share my own testimony. And most of the questions centered around the testimony and those aspects of my personal encounter with these people. And so they were open at that time. I don't know if they're as open now as they were at that time. Yeah. But that was a remarkable experience considering the way in which we would be treated here in this country.
Let me ask you another question on that connected point, David. And that is, it's a question about intellectual humility. I have found in my own studies in philosophy, in theology and other history, that I think it's very important that I have humility. But part of being an intellectual and part of being involved in scholarship is I tend to care about my prestige. I care about the letters at the end of my name. I care about, how I'm perceived. Is it possible that a robust intellectual life could undermine intellectual humility?
I'm not sure exactly in what sense you mean that.
Let me put it a little differently. I know I do, and I think at RTB we prize the intellect. We prize thinking and reasoning. And yet it's possible to kind of limit your options because you are not open, maybe intellectually or spiritually, to maybe a different way of thinking. And I guess I'm kind of pushing the envelope by saying, is it possible being an intellectual is overstated?
Well, I mean, I certainly believe that I certainly have experienced hesitancy in sharing my faith because I'm fearful that they will consider me kind of an odd bird.
Yeah.
Or I'll lose credibility with people. Being a member of the team here at Reasons to Believe and having a lot of the arguments that we use has kind of helped me to be able to express myself. It's kind of like what you were saying earlier. When you talk to people using an abductive sort of approach, you're not arguing that these are proofs, but you're offering people a way of thinking about things that might open up a discussion and you know, have a discussion that involves spiritual things without necessarily making them feel uncomfortable. When I go to a doctor, for instance, the questions I ask are, does faith play a role in your life at all? Mm. And that kind of opens up, you know, they'll ask, well, what do I mean by faith? And then, you know, it gives me a chance to share a little bit of my own. So you can do it in a way that doesn't necessarily destroy your credibility. But I certainly have had experiences where I've been fearful to do that because in my scientific work, because I don't want them to think that I'm a nutcase.
Yeah. All right. Well, guys, I think this is probably a good stopping place. In the next program, I'd like to kind of present a detailed abductive approach to why I think Christianity has very plausible explanatory power about the world, about humankind, and about the nature of reality.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Ken. We've been talking about Ken's book, Christianity Cross-Examined. If you don't have a copy, be sure and get one soon. I might add, at the time of our recording, your book, Ken, has been number one for a little while, at least in its category. So congratulations on that. And thanks to those who have already picked it up. You'll find it very readable and very useful as you are learning from Ken's descriptions on these podcasts. So we're going to talk more about the book on the next podcast, but we sure hope you pick up a copy for yourself. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast, and you'll see Straight Thinking there. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.